It's our third day of Sesshin. It's December today. The last month of the year. It's almost Christmas. And it's almost Rahatsu, the 8th of December. So typically, I guess at Zen centers around the world, Rahatsu, the enlightenment of the Buddha, is celebrated on the 8th of December, and usually there's a Sesshin around this time or close to it. And typically a Rahatsu Sesshin is more intensive than a regular Sesshin. You know, we don't do that here, it's just our regular Sesshin, but you might get up earlier or it's longer. We used to do 10-day Rahatsu Sesshins and be up before we went to bed and things like that. And Mozumi Roshi used to say that during Rahatsu Sesshin that he would present himself before the Buddhas and the ancestors. So just that aspiration. And the Buddha, I was kind of reflecting on the Buddha, you know, 2,500 years ago in India. He came out of a time and place that was obviously really different to our time and place here. But he kind of had the same kind of yearnings and questions that we have about life. But his particular environment was it's quite interesting because back then in India, and still to this day, and obviously still here in the West too, there's the practice of asceticism was quite prevalent. And asceticism basically says that the body and mind are split into two. And to free the mind, you mortify the body. And so that's in some of the old Christian practices as well. And if you did it enough, then the mind would be freed. And so the Buddha engaged in ascetic practices for about 6 years. And there's a lovely statue of the Buddha too, of totally emaciated. And you can kind of say he was down to a grain of rice a day, and he could grasp his backbone through his stomach. So that was the practice, and all the practices are kind of documented about burying himself alive and going without breath, going without food. I've seen some in India, you see some of the old rishis and sages who are grow the fingernails long. There's one guy, I think it might be a few of them, it's like he had his hand up in the air for years, and his arms emaciated and these kind of practices around that real split between the body and mind, and so the Buddha was I guess engaging in these kind of practices, but after the story goes that he's sitting on the bank of a river, and he's down to 7 grains of rice a day, and he just collapses into the water. And he gets rescued by a young goat herd, and she drags him out and sees that he's on the edge of death, and gives him something to drink, goat's milk. And at that point he's overcome, I guess, with the simple act of compassion that they just kind of shakes himself. It's like, what the hell have I been doing? And it's almost like that first turning for him. And so he strengthens his body, and when he feels stronger, he eventually decides he's just going to do Zazen. And he sits underneath a tree, a peepal tree, and sits. And his what's interesting is, so his five friends who are practicing with him at the time, four, five, they were all ascetics as well. They formed the gang of the best ascetics in India. And So they see him basically, you know, stop doing the practices and starting to eat. And they're totally disgusted. They basically, you know, feel like he's gone off the trail and so they abandon him. And so so what he did was quite revolutionary. It was to actually have that first inkling that the, you know, the way of subjugation of the body was not yielding anything for him. So he practiced assiduously for 6 years and was the king of the ascetics. So he abandoned, you know, at that point he abandoned his path. And if you think about it, it's like if you've been doing something really intensively for that amount of time, and then you have that shift, you know, how that would feel. You know, it's like it's like losing something. It's like a death or can also be a liberation, but that shift was quite it was huge. So he abandoned, you know, all his teachers. He abandoned his companions. He abandoned his dogma, his understanding, his religion, I guess, in a certain sense. He abandoned, you know, Hinduism, all the stuff that he'd been, and basically sat underneath this tree and said, you know, it's like, I'm going to just sit here in openness, and if I die, then so be it. And so just on the edge, you know, totally open, not relying on anything. And so the story goes that during that time, as he sat under the tree for 7 days, that he was confronted with everything that we are confronted with. You know, it's like, you know, when you're sitting zazen, all these kind of fantasies and challenges come up for us, and, you know, about food and sex and power, and I want to get up and leave, and all these kind of things came up for him, and so he just sat all through this, and so not relying on anything, and being open to this experience that just comes at us, or is us, you know, 24/7, and so. You know, the story of his awakening is, you know, kind of well known. He on the seventh day he looks up and he sees Venus rising in the east, and he says, "A wonder of wonders, you know, all beings have the virtue and wisdom of the Tathagata Buddha. In other words, and all beings are perfect and complete as they are. And there's nothing to strive for, nothing to seek." This experience that we are is there's no choice about it. And he says, but because of our upside down thinking, you know, we fail to see it. So we seek after things. And then he went and sat there for a while, say a number of days, weeks, month, and then Indra, this is God, Indra, came and said, you know, you should teach this. He said, how can you teach this? It's like, you know, it's not teachable. It's not a thing about teaching or translating. This is what I've done is to basically to let go of all that kind of stuff, all that pointing and stuff. This is direct. This is my life. But Indra just says, you know, winked at him and said, you'll find a way. And so then began that great stream of karma. And that first, with the ascetics, is you know, he goes and finds his ascetic friends, and they're like, guns, Shakyamuni, loser. You know. But they're kind of struck by something about him. And And then he talks about the Four Noble Truths, and that's the we talked about on the first day of Sesshin, and about the truth of suffering or anguish, and the causes, and then realization, and then cultivation of the path. And so, you know, then so he taught throughout 80 until he was 80, and died painfully, they say, from food poisoning. And but before the end of his life, he revised the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the final part of the Four Noble Truths. Because after, you know, 40 years of practice, he kind of had a little more kind of wisdom or insight. So he basically revised his initial teaching. And one of the bits was about, it was called the Eight Awarenesses of the Awakened Person. And one of them is about, says, want little and know how to be satisfied. So this little phrase, which is kind of used to describe Zen, but it's also, you know, it's Buddhism. It's kind of a nice way to think about our practice. So it's sometimes termed like a special transmission outside the sutras. It's not relying on words or letters, pointing directly to the heart and the realization of Buddhahood or selfness. Or non-selfness. So, you know, it's gone on from 2,500 years down to today, and when we chant that suit, the lineage each morning, you know, we trace a line from Shakyamuni Buddha down to the last name on the list is Hakyu Taizan Dai Osho. Dai Osho means great teacher. Osho, Dai. Osho means teacher, Dai, in Japanese for great. And so it traces that lineage, and traces a specific lineage, traces a Soto Zen lineage from the Buddha down through my teacher who's died. You get on the list when you die, so you have to wait. And and our line particularly comes down through the line that we chant, comes down through, if you chant it tomorrow, then Tozen Ryokai is the founder. Our lineage is called Soto, and Soto comes from two teachers, Sozan and Tozan. And Tozen Ryokai is regarded as the founder of the Soto school, so a particular kind of flavor of Zen, and that's our flavor. And comes down through Dogen Zenji, who was the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, who brought Soto Zen to Japan, and then down through today. And before Maizumi Roshi, there's Bayan Hakujin Dai Osho, and Bayan Hakujin was Maizumi Roshi's father, actually, and his, I guess, kind of root teacher. So Maizumi Roshi was born into, I guess, a kind of priestly family. So and the Soto school has you know, monks marry, and he had, I think, eight brothers, and the majority of them ended up being priests, and Maizumi Roshi was the youngest. Their family name was Kuroda, but he got Maizumi was his name. His mother's name was Maizumi. The youngest son normally takes the mother's name to ensure the name doesn't doesn't die out. So but he also Maizumi Roshi. So he inherited the Soto line, but he also studied with Yasutani Roshi, who was another Soto Zen teacher, but had training in the Rinzai school. And he also studied with Koryu Roshi. And Koryu Roshi was a lay Zen teacher in Tokyo, in a place called the Hanya Dojo. And I actually talked about Bernie Roshi, who died recently. And Bernie Roshi also studied with Koryu Roshi in Japan. And Koryu Roshi was a lay teacher. And he was taught by a teacher called Joko Roshi, who was a Rinzai priest. But Joko Roshi was so disgusted with the priesthood that he strictly forbade Koryu Roshi to become ordained. And would not ordain him as a monk. He said, you need to. So in Japan, I guess, you know, that it's very much the very much institutionalized religion. So sometimes you get firebrands like Joko Roshi or Yasutani's teacher Harada Roshi, who basically, you know, would say things like, you know, all priests should be burned, and all temples should be destroyed, just because of the clinging onto kind of forms and power and money. And so, so that's our line that we come down to today. So we kind of have those three lines, and the Rinzai line is where we get our kind of koan influence as well, because the Rinzai school tends to use koans. And I'd like to just touch on a koan today, which is about Zen Master Rinzai. So Rinzai is our in our lineage. There's like the Soto lineage, who is Tozan and Tozan, and then there's the Rinzai lineage, which started with Master Rinzai, or Master Linji, which is Linji. It's back in China around about 800 AD. And and sometimes these lines are called by their founders because they, I guess when you look back, you kind of would say, well, something changed there. There was some kind of flavor change, Master Rinzai was someone who I guess revitalized a line and encouraged a form of practice that really can be recognized down to today. And you get a bit of a flavor here of Master Rinzai. They say the Rinzai school is kind of a vigorous form of Zen. It's a bit like the father or a kind of certain masculine energy, where the Soto school has a more of a the mother or the feminine energy. So this is case 86 in the Book of Serenity, and the Book of Serenity is this is a Book of Serenity, and it contains 100 koans that were collected by a master called Yuan Wu, and they're part of our koan study. And so each koan is they're kind of like stories, Zen stories, and they have an introduction, the main case, which is the koan itself, and then they have a verse, and normally have a commentary by a teacher as well to kind of elucidate them. And we bring these up because they form a kind of an insight into how you express, you know, your understanding. They're kind of like, it's all very well to sit, you know, and to be one with everything. But what the koans do is that they kind of this question is like, you know, if everything returns to the one, what does the one return to? Well, the answer is everything, you know. But just to let you know, but there's that thing about, you know, it's like there is of course there is, you know, there's a, that basic undifferentiated experience which we are moment to moment, and we experience that by letting go of thought. But there's also this world of, you know, up and down and good and bad and take care of others and how do we deal with climate change and all that. And so these koans are kind of, a lot of the koans are really pointed at that. It's like, so how do you express it? How do you express your understanding? When you're challenged by this, how do you really put it into practice? So they ask you to say something. So if you work on koans, it's like, you know, you have a koan, say your koan, and then I'll ask you, so what is it? And then, so you've got to say something about it. You know, it's not good enough just to go, oh, you know, how's that going to help people? And that's kind of some of the koans are also leveled at, you know, monks who are sitting in caves, especially in the Zen tradition, it's kind of leveled at the. So what are you? You know, you can't just sit in a cave. How are you going to assist people? How are you going to be a bodhisattva? And so there's stories around those questions. How do you really put your practice into action? So this is called Linji's Great Enlightenment. Linji being obviously the original Chinese name, and Rinzai is the Japanese transliteration. So there's a number of characters in here, and Huangbo, who's mentioned here, or Baku in the Japanese form, is Linji's teacher, and Huangbo was about So he's about 7 foot tall, a really strong man, and he had a big callus on his forehead, and he had a callus on his forehead because he was thought of himself as being a really, obstinate person. So he did a lot of bowing, and he bowed so much to try and put down his egotism and that he ended up with this callus on his forehead. So you see some of his statues, and he's got this lump on his forehead because he bowed so much. And so Linji asked Huangbo, "What is the true essential great meaning of the Buddha's teaching?" Huangbo immediately hit him. This happened 3 times. Then Linji left Huangbo and visited Dayu. So you can imagine what's happening there. It's like, every time he asks him, this kind of like, in all earnestness, "What is the essential great meaning of the Buddha's teaching?" And Huangbo just whacks him. So he visited Dayu, and Dayu asked, "Where have you come from?" Linji said, "From Huangbo." And Dayu said, so Dayu knows Huangbo, says that. "So what did Huangbo say?" Linji said, "3 times I asked about the truly essential great meaning of the Buddhist teaching, and 3 times I was beaten with a stick. I do not know if I had any fault or not." And Dayu said, "Huangbo was so kind. He did his utmost for you. And still you come and ask if there is any fault or not." And at this, Linji was greatly enlightened. So that koan is quite sweet in a way. I mean, we don't go around beating each other, these days, but it just expresses the kind of vigorousness of this. And also, I guess, Linji's great determination. That he wasn't going to take being hit with a stick to put him off. And what was Huangbo teaching him? And then he comes to Dayu, still with great kind of, what is the essential teaching of Buddhism? What is my life about? And Dayu, very compassionately, he said, "Huangbo was so kind. He did his utmost for you. And still you come and ask if there is any fault or not." Just like that. Huangbo was so kind. How was Huangbo kind? "He hit me with a stick. He did his utmost for you. And still you come and ask if there is any fault or not." So that's kind of the I guess part of the flavour of Rinzai Zen is about that immediacy. Whenever we're I guess struck by life's great challenges, we like Rinzai, want to know whether it's my fault or was it someone else's fault. Did I see it right? Did I see it wrong? All these kind of questions come up for us. And this koan, Rinzai goes back to Huangbo 3 times. And Huangbo is a 7 foot giant. So I think Rinzai is quite small. And so the kind of courage it probably took to go through. Because after, once you go like, okay, maybe I got something wrong. Second time, you'd be like, So you go back a third time, you're probably thinking you're going to get hit again. And he does. And at that point, just like, oh, fuck it. I'm out of here. But he's not, he goes and sees Dayu, who's well known to Huangbo as another teacher, and still really confused about it. Says, what? And at that point, Dayu kind of basically turns and says, "Huangbo, how compassionate he was." He gave you the teaching, and still you're trying to work out whether there's fault or not. You're still kind of thinking about stuff. Still trying to fix something. And at that point, Rinzai just like opens, you know. It's like, and it's a great skill of Dai Yu to kind of see that in him as well. Just gives him a little little poke. And he kind of sees that he's been practicing with Obaku for many years, and then you know, at that point he's kind of quite open. So, and with a koan like this, it's like, so that's Rinzai's story, but it's our story. And so it's where we really internalize that kind of koan. It's like, so, you know, in that sense of like, you know, being, putting ourselves out there, being vulnerable, and then getting, you know, hit with the stick. And we do it again. And we get knocked down. And we do it again. And we get knocked down. You know, and it's quite, when you think about Rinzai at that point, so then he leaves, you know. And it is a little bit like, well, you know, after you've been knocked down three times and you've really been open and vulnerable, you know, whatever, however that comes in relationship or trying, whatever it is that you're you want to achieve in life, and then after a while of reflection, you know, then he kind of seeks out someone else and asks again. What does Dai Yu do? Dai Yu just kind of turns it slightly, and just like it shines that light on the compassion of Huang Bo, you know, and so for us is that what's been shown to us, what great compassion has been shown to us, you know, on a momentary basis. You know, so, and Rinzai kind of sees that, or it is shown to him. You know, he doesn't. He realizes, you know, a that Huang Bo's stick was Huang Bo's stick, and that Dai Yu's compassion is Dai Yu's compassion, and was there any fault or not? And it was not needed. He didn't need to use that crutch, that kind of questioning, that doubting, that trying to work things out. Direct teaching. You know, so that's so for us, you know, that's instructive in that, you know, when we in life and you know, especially say over the next 24 hours as we, you know, come into the home straight of Sesshin, is the, you know, this Obaku stick, you know, that's being presented moment by moment by moment, you know, and our practice is we notice ourselves asking that question, you know, is there any fault or not, am I doing this right, you know, it's like all those kind of questions that come up for us. And, you know, our practice really is to be aware or alert to the ourselves asking that question and trying to work things out. Trying to check if there's something at fault with my experience, my moment-to-moment experience. And when we notice ourselves doing that, then you just come back. And that's what Huang Bo was showing, you know, it's like that stick every time. Wake up. So yeah, so that's that line, that 2500 years line, is, you know, kind of ends and begins here. And you know, as I was mentioning before, is that the Chris and Lillian are selling, will be selling this property, moving out probably next, by May at the latest. And so now Sishin's in June. And so there's no guarantee, you know, that we'll be back here, which is, would be sad. We've been coming here for 15 years, you know, and it could be the last time, so, or maybe not, who knows. But just that transience, you know, of life. And, you know, so this could be your last opportunity to do session at Riversley. And, so yeah, just urge all of us, you know, to really, really take advantage of it. You know, there's no time like the present. Yeah, that's all we have. So, yeah, 24 hours. So I just really encourage us to really put everything into it. You know, that means really engaging, you know, engaging with the practice, you know, moment by moment. Letting go of the thoughts, letting go of the ideas, letting go of the stories. And just coming back to that direct experience, you know, which is represented as Huangbo's stick. But for us, whatever it is, moment by moment. Okay, let's finish.